kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education, episode number 73. I am Di Byrnes and this is...
I'm Doug Belshaw. So this is a safer, more private internet. Interesting stuff to talk about today, but first of all, Di, how are you and what you've been up to?
Well, I haven't spoken to you in a couple of weeks, so quite a lot of things have passed by in that time. I had the pleasure of meeting and giving a little tour around our school and having a pint with the global managing director of Dell Education on Friday, who was brought to our school by Richard Taylor, Dick Taylor on Twitter, and their friends, and so he's up staying for the weekend before BET. So it was nice to have a chat with them and talk about the Dell kit and all the different things that are going on from his point of view. And then it was...
Oh, you mentioned BET, so just really quickly, do continue on in a minute. But for those who are listening to this who are going to BET this week, before we go too far in, when are you going to be there and when am I going to be there?
So I'm going to be there on Thursday only.
Okay. And I'm going to be there on the Friday afternoon, getting the train down from the frozen wastelands of the north on Friday. I've got a couple of meetings. I've got many people who want to meet me for coffee, which is very nice. I'll be fully caffeinated. And then I'll be there pretty much all day Saturday. I'm doing a short talk, like a virtual thing. I'll be hanging out on the Raspberry Pi stand quite a lot. And basically, if you are there at the same time as me or Di, do give us a tweet. So Di, what's your Twitter handle?
Di Byrnes, DiBarnes.
And I'm DAJ Belshaw, because I have to use my middle name sometimes, DAJ Belshaw. Cool, sorry, do continue.
My focus at BET is to look at teacher tech, really, this time around. So I'm going to... So John Phillips, the guy from Dell, told me that Dell are producing a new Surface, Microsoft Surface Pro style hybrid 2-in-1 machine, a bit more like the Surface Book, one might say, but uses the same pen technology, and also that Chromebooks have just got that same technology as well, which he didn't know the details of the machine, so that's going to be on Google stand, so I'll go and check that out. And I think it is the Samsung Chromebook that they're just releasing, and it's not actually due for release until May. But the fact that a Chromebook will use that inking technology is quite a big deal. And then the Dell machine is supposed to come in less money than the Surface, which would be significant. But having looked through their stuff, it looks like an XPS 12 is the one that's going to be sort of touchscreen, foldable, overable kind of flipbook thing.
I did look at the XPS 12 actually, because they had some on the Dell reconditioned, or what's it called, the clearance outlet thing. And they did seem like a decent deal. I think to get them to run Linux as I want, it wasn't hard, but it wasn't, you know, they're not set up for that.
No, is your machine a touchscreen one?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so they are set up for that bit, Dell have an active pen, they call it, which looks very much like the Surface Pen, and so that's quite interesting. If we can bring those devices in at a lower price point, they obviously make great sense to a teacher, and it's kind of marketing thing. And I saw this thing today, actually, just while we're on kit, called Remarkable. Have you heard of that?
I don't think so.
It's a new device. It's coming at $720, I think, and they're putting on at half price, or pretty much half price, as for pre-order, not due to ship until August. But it's basically an e-ink device that you can sketch on and put notes on, and it will save it all directly into the cloud, etc. So it's designed to go with a computer, not be a computer itself, but to be e-ink, and beautiful, the most they claim for it to be the thing that's most like writing on paper, which I think has mileage for schools, obviously.
If you were going to do that, why wouldn't you just get an iPad?
Well, I think that's quite interesting. So I have an iPad Pro and have been using that with the Pencil. And I find the Surface Pencil has a better quality about inking. And so the iPad Pro is a little bit slippy. It's a bit like plastic on plastic kind of thing.
Okay.
And it's a different experience using the Surface. But I think it's much of a muchness, really. I think the biggest deal with inking products, other than that, is using OneNote, because it has an infinite canvas, which just makes much more sense because the work can explode from what is a piece of paper into a wider, bigger thing involving different kinds of media, combining text and handwriting and such like. Whereas if you're marking using something like Firefly or Google Classroom using through the app, you can ink on PDF snapshots of documents and it will save the inking.
Right, I do appreciate people, you know, organizations when they go beyond the constraints. I read a while ago, it was called Breaking the Page. It was a book about books and about ebooks in particular and about why the kind of skeuomorphic desire to make books like physical books doesn't do ebooks justice. And I just finished reading a book called Landmarks by Robert McFarlane. I might have mentioned that I was reading it last time. And it's all about nature and landmarks and words in particular, words that are being lost to describe very particular things in the British landscape. Anyway, this particular book, it's like a Waterstone special edition. I picked up secondhand, but this Waterstone special edition has these grainy black and white photos at the end of the book illustrating some of the things that the author's talking about. Well, of course, because it's got a glossary weaved throughout it, it's the perfect kind of thing for an ebook, because you want to see the things that the author's talking about, to see examples rather than just reading words on a page. But I don't think they've even done that, you know, in terms of taking all of those for the ebook version. So something like an infinite canvas sounds, yeah, eminently sensible to me.
Yeah, it does. And you can imagine in the tennis game that it is a feedback between a teacher and a pupil in a piece of work, that you don't necessarily want to go too big, but certainly the ability to write comments becomes a lot easier and much more sensible if you are able just to break the page a little bit. And it's always confused me really why Google haven't employed this from the off a little bit. There's always been a thing, you know, when you're editing a Word document and you can have it in different views, and you normally just have print view so it looks like a piece of paper on the screen. And it's the WYSIWYG, what you see, what you get, sort of principle, which is sensible. But if you change it to a web page, then the page disappears and it just fills the space, and you can have different background colors and things. And I always kind of wondered why you need those barriers down the side in the way that you do. And I guess it limits how the kit is programmed, how the software works. But anyway, this is sort of eminently.
Yeah, but in the same way that, you know, a lot of services have started removing the floppy disk icon to save, because, you know, my kids have certainly never seen a floppy disk or a cassette tape or anything like that. I think you're right in terms of the metaphor just needs taking away, because who's it helping? Who is it scaffolding? It's certainly not scaffolding generations who don't really need that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's interesting. So anyway, this remarkable device just looks good because it's a plain shooting kind of handwriting piece, reading and writing piece, a device, and that will lend itself to schools in many different ways, and it connects up to your accounts and you can do what you like with it. So that looks good.
Cool.
Yeah.
My laptop finally came, a bit of a saga there in that, well, it's perfect. So when we've just been talking about this before we hit record, but when you're used to Amazon Prime delivery, and when you're used to ordering Apple, even on their refurbished store, and it arrives in 2-3 days, they basically made this on demand because it's the top-end spec Ubuntu version of the Dell XPS 13, and so you can track it directly from China all the way across. And they said it was going to arrive tomorrow, so it was going to arrive on Wednesday. And it actually arrived today. But the reason it arrived today was because UK Mail twice came to deliver it and left a note when I was actually in the house, which is all kinds of ridiculous. So I could have had it a week earlier, but never mind. But yeah, just when you're used to amazing customer service, when you don't get it, it really, really grates on you. So it's a lovely machine. You know, I feel almost too old to get too excited about technology, but it has a screen that is insane resolution, even higher than my Chromebook Pixel. It's like 3,200 pixels across. It's actually the same physical size as my Lenovo ThinkPad X220, which had actually a smaller screen because the bezel is so thin on this new Dell XPS 13 that the webcam can't fit at the top middle of the screen and has to go in the bottom left, which, as we experienced just then when we were talking, is slightly awkward. But at the same time, it feels about the same form factor as a, you know, the MacBook, the newish MacBooks. It looks kind of carbon fiber-ish. And yeah, it's very nice and it's fast, so all good.
Cool. Well, that sounds good, and so should a very expensive new machine be lovely.
Mm.
But that's nice that it is.
Yeah.
We did this interesting thing last week. So we got our IT technicians actually got a speaker in, or two speakers in, called Cal Leeming and Darren Martin. Do you recognize those names?
I do not. What did they do?
Well, Cal Leeming is convicted. Both of them actually have been in prison for hacking. And now work in security.
Oh, interesting.
So we had a couple of hour talk on with loads and loads of different examples of hacking and what they've been up to. And well, certainly Cal went through his life, which was to say he was dealt a shit hand is underserving it really. And
is he the guy? I think I'm confusing this. There's a guy who went on the Tim Ferriss podcast who talked. I think he was American though. Who talked about how he got involved, and basically what happened was his mother, you know, it's the, you know, we talk these days about parents abandoning or abdicating responsibility and just giving their kids a tablet and telling them to shut up.
Uh-huh.
Basically, his mother did the equivalent with a second-hand PC when he was 12 and just went out to work her 2-3 jobs and told him to get on with it, and he learned how to become a hacker. Was it a similar story there or no?
No, his sort of backstory is quite compelling, really, and interesting. But he grew up in a life of sort of emotional and physical abuse and drugs and things like that. And the police, police were around his house most days, in Coventry, I think it was. And he's quite open about this and has told his story many times. And so when he actually got the police knocking his door down, quite literally, when he was 12 years old for hacking stuff that he had done, he's now 35, I think. And
wow.
And he was just like, as soon as he worked out what a credit card was, when he was 8, then he was away and just worked out how to do all sorts of different hijinks, earning himself free stuff. So but anyway, so really, really, really interesting talk. So lots of different things and tips on hacking, but they were very convinced that the internet is insanely unsecure.
Mm, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, when I talk about VPNing my traffic through a custom server in Frankfurt, people look at me as if, like, why have you changed your ISP to, like, a non-mainstream provider? Like, all these hoops that I'm jumping through, making my life more difficult and not going with all of the slick stuff. But, you know, people put a value on things, and some people put a monetary value, and I put a value on time and independence and autonomy, and so I'm certainly not at anything near their level, but I do see the need, having worked for Mozilla, seen kind of into the abyss and in a very limited way of just how bad these things can get.
Yeah, it was so it is quite interesting, and they get very bad, but the question is consequence. So they showed us lots of things, like there's a website called sodan.io. have you seen that?
What? Sodan? No.
Sodan, I believe. I think that's it. No, it's not that. It's something else. I'll have to have a look for it. But Shodan. That's what it is. Sorry, not Sodan. It's Shodan. SHO. Sorry, my mind is not with me in enough speed.
Oh, the world's first search engine for internet-connected devices.
Exactly. So through that, they showed us lots of little ways that you can put, like, terms you can put in the search box to hunt down people's webcams that are unsecure.
Okay.
And you can just see into their front rooms and wherever their webcams.
And like their Amazon Echo devices as well?
No, it doesn't do that, yeah. Sure. Well,
did you see today, was it today, that Amazon said that you can? It's now got a new command. You can now say computer.
Oh, really? Well, it does Echo. What's it do? Echo, Amazon, and the magic word, which I won't say. More crazy things happen. But that's good. I bought a little adapter for my hi-fi, actually, a Jongo, a pure Jongo, it's called, which makes my hi-fi into, if it was only 20 quid, it makes my hi-fi work with the magic words. So,
very cool.
Yeah, it's good.
Good. Well, when I was thinking about my particular setup, and I did write a short blog post on my discourses blog, for my own benefit, just in case I totally cock something up about the Linux apps that I'm using regularly. So I might put that link in because that might be useful for some people. I know certainly it's easy to think that the network that you're in is symptomatic. I mean, Brexit and the Trump kind of election shows all this. It's easy to think that your network is illustrative of the wider populace, but there seems to be a lot of people who are dissatisfied and considering Linux. But obviously, I guess my network might be people who for whom they know of Linux, and that's not a scary thing. But I've got a thing called Linux apps I install by default, and a lot of these are cross-platform just because I started using them on Mac, and have moved across. A lot of these are not going to be unfamiliar to you, or to anyone for that matter. These are things like Audacity, which I use to edit this podcast. They're things like Firefox, which syncs across all devices and is cross-platform. Things like Flux, which shifts the color temperature. The GIMP, the GNU image manipulation program, which is like Photoshop. One which I've been reading a book, Di. Did you see this in the Slack channel about cognitive productivity? Did we talk about this last time?
I don't think so.
No. So Cesar Garcia, who is in our Slack channel, recommended this book. And the book is like 850 pages. And it's almost like this guy's life work. And it's far too long. It should be a quarter of the length. But I find the idea of cognitive productivity really interesting because it's almost an academic workflow. How do you make sure that you don't just read things, but you learn them and you can apply them? And one of the things he talks about is having meta docs. And a meta doc is a document about the thing that you're studying or reading, and you make notes in a structured and ordered way so that you can then test yourself on that and do that kind of spaced learning and the factual recall, which allows you to then synthesize the things that you're learning. And one of the things that he recommends over and above like a slew of Mac apps, he seems to think everyone uses Mac, is something which we've mentioned before called Notational Velocity. But again, I think I have mentioned this before, is there's one called NVPy, as in Python, and it works really nicely on Linux. And so it syncs with SimpleNote. It allows you to do markdown and things, but basically you can create simple notes, which you can tag. And when you start typing, it is automatically finding the things with that particular string. And if it doesn't have that, you can press enter and create it straight away. It's an amazing thing, especially if you're talking to someone, as I do, you know, setting up keynotes, workshops, that kind of stuff, getting client requirements, also just writing down random ideas because it syncs the SimpleNote app on my phone. It's a great, great tool. And I'm guessing it works on Windows or someone's written a fork as well. So I do like cross-platform apps because it does give you the flexibility to be able to recommend the thing that you like, especially if it's free and open source as well, to anybody and know that they're not going to have a huge cost barrier or not be able to use it because they don't use the right platform.
Yeah, I think it's right. I think there's always there's always a certain set of apps that you install, and it's interesting how Microsoft and Apple now are giving away their apps for free, their sort of Office apps thing. Although I don't think Microsoft do, but if yeah, maybe a little bit. And but I like this strapline: Simple Note Syncing Note Taking Application, inspired by Notational Velocity and Resoft Notes, but uglier and cross-platformerer.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? Like, there's loads of Mac apps which are great, but they're expensive, or they just only work with Mac.
It's one of the great disappointments of life that people are so into Photoshop and not GIMP. It's just one of the things. I still use GIMP instead of Photoshop in my lessons, and I just feel like I'm out there alone, all by myself.
I'm using it as well, Dan.
Yeah. But as a teacher, you know, just like passing as a tool to young people, sort of things we use it. And just thinking what we use in lessons, so Firefox, Audacity, just from your office, Skype we would use, obviously, for different.
I just think it's a real shame that there was a bit of a movement. There was an open source schools thing with Bechter. I remember Miles Berry and other people were. Some of the people who listened to this were involved with it, and it ended up not getting the funding it needed, people start arguing, all that kind of stuff. But there's something extremely powerful about saying, okay, kids, and you get some of this through when you use Google Apps saying, you know, you can continue this at home because it's all web-based. But at that particular time, you know, 10, 11 years ago, something very powerful about saying, you know, here's a USB stick or whatever, there's an operating system, there's all the apps you need, off you go. And especially in some of the places that you've visited in Africa, some of the places in the world where they haven't got the fast internet access, they haven't got the infrastructure, or they haven't got the ability to be able to connect to some of the Microsoft stuff or the Google stuff, or they don't want to for privacy and security reasons, which we're going to come on to in a moment. It's just extremely powerful to be able to give people everything they need.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And it's all, you know, it's the whole teaching how to fish thing. It's a big deal. It's not a small thing.
So one of the things to mention, which I guess I knew at the back of my mind, but I had never really messed about with, someone wrote, and I'll not link to it here because it's just overly geeky, but on Hacker News, someone linked to something like the ultimate Linux setup. And what he was trying to get at was that the operating system is made up of different components. And whereas on Mac and Windows, you have to go with what Microsoft and Apple say, Linux is almost infinitely configurable. So, for example, you can have a different login manager to your display manager, to the distribution that you're using, which could be forked from something else. And so he'd come up with all these different recommendations. And what it reminded me of is that when people praise amazing things about operating systems, it's the equivalent of the desktop, like the window manager. And I realize I'm getting into the realms of going over some people listen's heads, but one thing that I've realized is that there are some things in the world of like Unix and Linux that have been constantly developed for 20 years as open source projects run by volunteers. So, for example, GNOME, GNOME, all capital letters, that used to be the window manager, the display manager for Ubuntu, and it's still being developed. And actually, when I tried it, I've now installed it instead of Unity on Ubuntu because it's so good. Like, it's Mac-like. I was using Elementary OS to get that Mac-like experience, but actually this is, you know, vanilla Ubuntu with GNOME installed, and it's just great.
Okay, it's good to know.
Yes. Cool. I did get slightly pissed off, I have to say, that I spent 700 quid on a laptop just to get Linux on it, and it came and it arrived, and it had a frickin' Windows key on it.
Microsoft rule the world.
So I've spent £1.50 on a little vinyl sticker on eBay of a penguin to stick on it over the top of it. So yeah.
Well, I wonder if you could buy a new key. Like, if it's the same shape as one of the others, you could just like buy a spare key and to pop the key off and put it on instead.
Well, there's a guy called Matt Jukes who, he's kind of in the wider Mozilla community. And when I put on Twitter how pissed off I was, he'd literally bought the same laptop a month before, and his didn't. I don't know what it was on it, but his didn't come with the Windows thing. So anyway,
what was on it instead?
I don't know what was on it instead, but I'd love to know. I mean, it wouldn't be hard to put the Ubuntu logo on, would it? I mean, for goodness sake.
No, I know, but it's just mass production shit, isn't it? So yeah. It's all good.
Anyway, I will take matters into my own hands. I've already started putting stickers on the back of it, so I will get more as time goes on. Anyway, one last thing by way of introduction. So Laura Hilliger, hi Laura, if you're listening, who is a member of our co-op. I worked with at Mozilla, and she works part-time for Greenpeace as well. She decided to buy a new MacBook Pro and one without the touch bar because her MacBook Air was getting towards the end of its useful life. And I thought it was a good opportunity to encourage her to write her thing about the setup. So the setup is a website. It's at usesthis.com. And they go out and they talk to all different kinds of people who work in tech, in artistic endeavors, all different types, and they talk about like who are you and what do you do, what hardware are you using, what software, and like what would be your dream setup. So these are the four questions they ask everyone. But they also encourage the community, the people who read it, to post on their own website what setup they have, and then there's a huge list. And I did mine like 5 years ago, so I'm due an update. But I encouraged Laura, and Laura helpfully has actually written her setup at laurahilliger.com/the-setup. And it's really interesting. You know, I knew a lot of this, but there's some I didn't know about that. So, yeah, worth reading if you haven't come across this before.
Yes, I'm just looking at, she says she's enthralled with Passbot, which is not Passbolt, which is not as password management service. And it's free, open source, extensible, based on OpenPGP. Mm.
I have to say that since I realized, I knew this because I read the acquisition email, but LastPass, since 2015, are owned by LogMeIn, who are not a nice company. So I'm slightly locked into it in the sense of all my random passwords are in there. Well, I'm sure I can export them. But also, my wife and I use the LastPass sharing feature. So there's going to be a cost of switching there, but I think, as ever, it's worth switching towards free and open source stuff. So, yeah, lots of... I mean, the reason why the setup is great is because, and Laura's no exception here, people put in loads of links to the stuff that they recommend. And so there's all kinds of stuff in Laura's recommendations here, along with a few GIFs, which is always handy.
Can't argue with a good GIF. Excellent. Right, so today we are discussing, and touched on in a little way, a safer, more private internet.
Yes.
So a few links to look at.
So are you going to be marking, celebrating, doing anything with either the 2 days that are coming up? So on the 28th of January, it's Data Privacy Day. I think that's an international thing. And then I think it's on the 7th, is it? The 7th of February, it's Safer Internet Day.
SID, as it's called. Yes, so I was planning on doing things on Safer Internet Day, and I wasn't aware of Data Privacy Day until you brought it to my attention on Slack. And so I had a quick look at that. And because we've just had, so I'm doing encryption at the moment with both of my sixth form years, and we had the security chat or talk with Cal and Darren. So now we're going on to, I'm moving them on this week into privacy.
Right.
We're looking at that and getting them to sort of explore it and do a mind map of all the services that they're connected to, that they have data on, analyzing what that means and where they put up their defenses, where they're looking after their data. Where they're not, where does the service become critical to make it secure or as secure as possible, and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, because I'm at BET on Thursday, which is Data Privacy Day, I thought what I'd do is I'd charge one of the classes that I have that day. Their lesson will be to assemble a sort of three-step guide to checking out your data privacy, and that could be sent to all the other pupils in the school. Looking at
it. It's Data Privacy Day on Saturday, I think, actually.
Is it? I thought it was the 28th.
Yeah, so it's 28th on Saturday.
Oh, you see? I'm just in the wrong day, probably in the wrong time
zone. No, but I think Mozilla celebrate January as Data Privacy Month, so I don't think there's anything wrong with saying like this week or next week is
No, that works better for me. It gives me more of a chance to review it rather than reviewing it on my way back from bed. I can review it at my, you know,
yeah,
at my leisure, as it were.
No, I think that's a good idea.
So
I mean, I did a presentation. So, you know, those presentations where you know that sometimes you're not actually presenting really to the audience in front of you, but you're doing stuff to help further your own thinking and because you're going to make the slides more generally available. Mm-hmm. This was totally one of those. I did a presentation, which we've actually talked about before. This was back in 2014 when I was still at Mozilla. I called it Privacy Getting Beyond Meh, as in M-E-H. Mm-hmm. And there's a particular part of this which I spent some time on, trying to think through the metaphors and everything, because one of the things which gets me is that there's a fallacy, I think, in some people's thinking. Now, it's entirely up to people whether they want to give up their privacy. But that seems to then bleed over into, and I don't care about my privacy, and I don't really think I need to be that bothered about my security. And I don't think it's necessarily a conscious thing. I think it's just a general laxness. And so the metaphor, I don't think it's me who's come up with this, it's probably just come out of the reading that I did, but when you have a concern about privacy, you know, privacy is the reason why we put curtains on our windows. So when I'm getting changed in my house, if it's during the day, I will close the curtains, because even though it's unlikely someone can see in my bedroom window, I don't particularly want people to see me, the random strangers see me naked. Yeah. So that's why we put curtains on our windows. And security, using the same metaphor, is why we put locks on our doors. So there might be lots of people who decide in lots of situations that they don't want any curtains, or they don't really mind if people see in their windows. You know, when you walk past streets in twilight, there are lots of people who don't bother shutting their curtains early, and you can see right in when they're watching TV and things. But I'm guessing that most of those people would make sure that they lock their doors at night. So privacy and security, for me, are two related but pretty separate things.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's correct. And it's important to see. So if you're looking after your data privacy, you're going to have to be more secure. So they are related. But I think the way you talk about them, you need to talk about them in different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but it's difficult to use metaphors when you start talking about the web, just like it's difficult to talk about relationships and the whole thing about fake news, which I'm sure will come up again. Because when you get into networked environments, you know, different things happen. So, for example, it's difficult to talk about two-factor authentication with people, because there isn't like a homely metaphor in the world, really, apart from, I don't know, using two locks on something or whatever like that. So really, when we talk about privacy, we're using our sense of sight as a metaphor. We're talking about how people can have different levels of being able to see into your home or into the thing that you're trying to protect. So something could be entirely, you could have a glass cube which everyone can see into it and there's no privacy, but it's entirely secure because there's no way you're going to get into it. Yeah. And vice versa, you could have a completely opaque box, but there's no lock on the door and it's easy to get in. So yeah, just being clear that these are two separate things. When I'm going to Geneva for Safer Internet Day to talk to the children there, and the staff as well, and I'm not sure if I'm talking to the parents, but they're going to be showing the film Screen Ages. And I just want to make that important point that privacy and security are two separate things. So sorry to harp on about that, but that's an important point there. And so when it comes to privacy and the difference between them, the nexus, the crossover between them is personal data, because some of our personal data we give away for free, or we give away in exchange for things. And sometimes that feels like an informed trade. Like, I will give you my email address if you give me this discount on a thing. Yeah.
Yep.
And so I refuse to have store cards like Marks and Spencer's or whatever it is, because I don't actually want people tracking my purchases. Whereas other people think that's absolutely fine. Like, there's loads of places where you go in, they say, oh, make sure that you put in your date of birth, because then we can give you a special offer on your birthday. Well, there's no way they're getting my birthday, thank you very much. But for some people, and that's absolutely fine, they're happy to give that up.
They are. To save them money.
Yeah.
Usually.
Yeah.
Which is okay, kind of.
But there's sometimes when your personal data that you didn't want to share is being freely traded without your knowledge. So we've talked before about how Facebook buy up offline databases so that they can have more knowledge about you and sell you to advertisers. And that's by the by, we've talked about that before. But there's a link I've put in here about, on the BBC News website. It's a kind of expose by Which, which is a bit like Consumer Reports in the US, if you're listening from there. And they say that personal and financial data is being traded on a huge scale, and in some cases where it's talking about details of your pension, bank account numbers, that kind of stuff, it's being traded for as little as 4 pence an item, which is crazy, isn't it?
Yes, of course it is, and I think the planet. I think as a user to Google, each user is worth about 200 quid a year, and how they make of you. And it's an interesting thing when you start to look at. So Google are the largest company in the world, and they make their money through advertising. 90% of their money through advertising, and that is all based on you using their services for free, because and they're selling your data. So they're not going to do much about that. But it's an interesting thing to sort of look at what these companies are after, really. So they're after personally identifiable information. That's the sort of key thing, I think. And it's something that you could, at some point in the future, possibly package up and sell to companies such as Amazon is a good example of this. For example, if you're an Amazon Prime account holder or subscriber or whatever, then you're sort of packaging up all of your habits and allowing them to access your purchasing habits, and as well as your viewing habits, as well as your music habits potentially, as well as your reading habits, and all that sort of thing. And that is personally identifiable to you.
Yeah. Now I'm listening. I'm imagining that a lot of people listening to this are have already taken some steps to kind of reclaim their privacy online, etc. But there's lots of people I come across, including members of my family, who say, "Well, I've got nothing to hide or whatever." And there's a website which we'll talk about in a minute called Me in My Shadow. It's actually got a quite a nice 8-day detox, which came out of a collaboration that Mozilla did a while back with that. Glass, they made it look a bit like an Apple store, but it was all about privacy and things. They've got a freely downloadable kind of course you can do an 8-day detox. But they've got this particular page on the shadow called, so the website is just myshadow.org, me and my shadow. If you go to the seven things about tracking, it says tracking, so what? Seven things we know you're going to say. And so should we just go through these quickly? Because I think that they're These are
Sure.
the common arguments, aren't they?
Absolutely. Number one, I've got nothing to hide.
So I mean the point they're making here, and it's not the easiest one to make in the world, but it's easier when you use that metaphor of curtains on a window. It says, you know, privacy is not about hiding, it's about autonomy, power, and control. It's about your ability to decide how you present yourself to the world. So, for example, celebrities, you know, you have the paparazzi, you have the telephoto lens, they feel like they can't just go and sunbathe in their own garden, they can't do whatever. And it's that, but on a scale of everybody, you know, so you're being filmed every time you walk down the street. You don't have the control of being able to put those metaphorical curtains up so that you can decide when or how you're being presented to the world. And there's somebody who is kind of ambivert, but you know, definitely needs time to recharge. You know, I'll have my game face on a bet, and I'll be my as extrovert as I possibly can be. But I will, you know, go back to my hotel room and go and rock myself in a corner for a bit afterwards. And if I didn't have that ability to do that, I'd be an emotional wreck.
Yeah, so this has been a concern about social media and young people, really, and how things have actually, you know, one of the aspects that I think things have changed, which people need to be aware of, rather than, you know, people talk about lots of things need to be aware of, but one of the key things I think you need to be aware of is that children no longer have privacy. So it used to be for you and I when we were young, we would go and close our front door as we came in from school, and that would be the end of social life unless we picked up the telephone or went out. And whereas for a young person today, because they're connected on social media and they have these accounts now participating in their social scene, they kind of, there's a pressure to be on Snapchat or to be on a Messenger or WhatsApp or whatever it might be, once their front door is closed and they're inside with their family. And that is, so when you're in difficult situations, as young people get into often, with their friends, and friendships are, you know, they're kind of roller coaster things, they're on and off. That you don't get any time from which to hide from those pressures. And I think that is not a new thing. I think people who are being bullied at school, for example, can quite often, when it's very serious, that mental landscape will go home with them, and they will live through that for 12 hours and then go back to school again and have to face it. And now I think that's amplified by the fact
Yeah, a couple of things on that. I mean, without wanting to share family details, my son was lashing out when he came home from school the other day, and it turns out there was a, as far as I could gather, quite a minor altercation, which really wound him up. And you forget how yeah, like a roller coaster their emotional lives are at such a young age. And also, just now, we had a conversation over the dinner table about, because I saw on the back of his Match of the Day magazine, a football magazine, for those who don't know it, the whole of the back of the magazine was an advert taken out by Childline, you know, advertising their phone service and website service for people who feel like they've got no one to talk to. And it led to a conversation about what you do if someone's sending you stuff on your phone. And, you know, my eldest, who's just turned 10, had no idea that you could block people on social media or even, you know, block.
But I think that's numbers. I think that's right, though. You see, this is an interesting thing. So I tell you what, so for example, on WhatsApp, you can mute a conversation for a select amount of time, forever, or you know, just for a day or for an 8-hour period or something. And I think that's a useful thing. And one of the things that we do when we talk to young people about handling their services and their kit is it's sort of a black or white thing. You know, it's really serious, so but actually it'd be much more useful to give the middle of the road problems an airing and sort of say, you know, you can just mute a conversation, and even if people are contacting you, you only look at it when you know your phone doesn't keep pinging and highlighting and things like that. Because and maybe that's something to consider, really. So certainly in what I'm thinking about doing for the end of the week and for Safer Internet Day, are opening up a much more intellectual debate about these things and talking about them in a very different way, and not talking about them in the at the far end of the rainbow kind of way, at the extreme of one end of a spectrum of...
I see. So
what I mean.
Because there's going to be a lot of times where it's a bit like us when we were younger, I guess, like... There's times when it's not so bad that you want to get your parents involved. And it's like that on social media as well. Like, someone's being a bit of a dick, but it's not like you want to block them forever. You just want them to, want to hear from them until they've calmed down a bit.
Yeah. So when you know, every night when you're sending me like 24 messages, direct messages on Twitter, as you always do, and I'm just like, for fuck's sake, will you just shut up? Because I'm trying to watch a film or something.
Thanks, Charlie.
But that's kind of my point. My point is that sort of handling normal traffic is probably much better to advise upon than handling car crashes. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's what I'm talking about. And I think
people kind of know that they're going to have to get someone involved if it's kind of nuclear, don't they?
Exactly. Everyone knows it's kind of, well, they do and they don't. I mean, that's the whole thing about grooming, I guess, and kind of the shame trap and things like that. So sometimes it does and sometimes it don't. I think people know when stuff's going wrong. I think you're right there. And but there's not always, they don't always feel they can do something about it. And I think that's important to take care of. And generally PSHE sessions and things like that are always guided at that sort of target audience, if you like.
I think a lot of... I tell you what it does do for what you've just described there, which I think is a great idea, that kind of shades of grey. Is that it shows that the people who are advising you, the adults, aren't just dinosaurs who think that you should block everyone at this drop of a hat, and actually they understand that the way that the landscape goes and the roller coaster and the ups and downs.
Yeah, I think that's important, really important, and completely underestimated by the array of products that are out there.
I am making note of that. I'm gonna find some more stuff about that.
Yeah, I think it's that. So that's what I'm thinking about for Safer Internet Day. Is I want to say some really interesting things I found, and this isn't safe. No, let's not talk about that. We'll do that next week.
Let's talk about security next week. But yeah, just going down this list, number two is this is on Me and My Shadow, the kind of seven things about tracking. Number two, I don't care that people know I ate cornflakes for breakfast. And, you know, people talk about this on Twitter as well. But as it says, you know, some things about where you go and what your health concerns are, that these are some things that you might not necessarily tell your romantic partner. These are things that you want to keep private. And, you know, a while ago we were talking about having a strong sense of self. It's very difficult to have a strong sense of self and know who you are and what you're about when every single little thing is of knowledge to somebody else. And we might think that, oh, it's just Google, but Google is a thing, is an organization that has employees. And in the same way that, although, you know, I'm sure they've got levels of rigor and security and stuff, in the same way that there's many scandals about police departments looking up and using information on people for purposes they shouldn't, like looking up the boyfriend of your teenage daughter, for example, there's going to be, I'm not saying it's necessarily Google employees, but that data that exists and looks pretty harmless, or who cares if they know where I've gone in a particular day?
Yeah, yeah.
That's like potentially available, yeah.
The NSA stat, when they say 91% of the data that we collect is deleted and erased without trace kind of thing, is just not used at all. Mm. And then you turn that statistic on its head and it's 9%, well, that's pretty much 1 out of 10. That means 1 out of 10 every communications are of interest to the NSA and they're using it.
Yeah, that's insane, isn't it?
And 1 out of 10, think about that. That's a lot.
And going back to the metadata thing, there was the whole thing about WhatsApp we were talking about 2 weeks ago. And the thing I wrote in my newsletter was that it doesn't really matter whether there's a backdoor to WhatsApp or not. I think the conclusion is that unless your threat model is that the US government are after you, there isn't really a backdoor in inverted commas. But it doesn't really matter because the metadata that can be obtained from using these services is like, oh, well, we don't know what the call was about, but he made it on the top of a bridge and he phoned the Samaritans. Yeah, we don't know what the conversation was about, though. Or he phoned the AIDS helpline and he talked for 2 minutes. And then afterwards he went straight to the pub and, you know, was in there for another 8 hours. Like, much can be inferred into these things.
And the key thing about metadata as well is not just the one of conversations, it's the pattern of conversations over time, like frequency. So when the frequency changes and things like that, that identify really what's going on in your life. Once if you start calling not just particular numbers that reveal something like the ones you were mentioning, but just like say you and I start all of a sudden talking for half an hour every day, that means something possibly.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what the metadata reveals.
Mm. Number three.
However, I would say, so there are certain things I'm very conscious of the fact that once upon a time I went through all of my social media and took off every photograph or evidence of me smoking.
Right.
So I thought that obviously wasn't a sensible thing. So it's about me manipulating people's perception of me because smoking is seen as a weakness, maybe, and not necessarily a good thing for a teacher to be doing, because they obviously care for young people and endorses that.
But that's another thing, that's self-censorship. So you should be able to present yourself in your entire, you know, in the way that you are without having to necessarily feel. I know that we always self-censor and we always kind of present our way in ourselves in a particular way. Mm. But I think what you just described is even worse in the US from what I can gather, in the sense of if you've ever been photographed as a teacher, especially if you're a woman holding a drink, then that's used as a stick to beat you with.
Or if you're putting, if you haven't got your stuff locked down and you're putting pictures of yourself in a bikini or I guess in your swim briefs, then you are not fit to be a teacher because you're effectively creating some form of pornography or it's just not appropriate for a teacher.
Funny, you know, there was a thing on, I'm not going to be able to find it quickly, but there was a thing on Twitter today and someone pulled a quote out of it and it was written by the CEO of basically a company that was going into Nigeria, I think, and providing digital education services. And the quote was something like, digital technology is the great leveler. And I thought, that's demonstrably false. Mm-hmm. Because technology, when it goes into an unequal landscape, as which everything is an unequal landscape, it just serves to polarize and to magnify the existing inequalities. And so, for example, there's a lot of misogyny in the world, and guess what? That gets amplified by technology. So,
yes, it does, and for reasons that are really quite obvious. But amplification of marginalized positions. So, in my experience, generally speaking, there's not a lot of misogyny in the world that I live in, particularly, in my bubble. but it gets amplified through social media and such like, as people are sharing things because they think it's funny and it's tongue in cheek and blah 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 blah. Mm.
Anyway, number three.
Number three is, it's just the internet. I did that with expression, I think.
Yeah, I've forgotten who it was. I think it was Christian Payne documentary. Yeah, he was at Thinking Digital ages ago. And he told a story about David Cameron. And he did a quick... He was in the green room for this particular thing when David Cameron, he happened to be there. And he basically said, oh, can I do a quick interview? And David Cameron said, where's it going? And Christian said, it's going to go on the internet. And he said, well, okay, just the internet, no further.
Well, that's just showing a misunderstanding, isn't it, of what it is. I don't know when that was, but...
No, it was a few years ago, but it's that kind of thing of, like, compartmentalizing what the internet actually is, which is a giant digital photocopying machine.
Exactly, and also a very public one. Mm. I don't know, but I think this happens quite a lot, and it's a big thing about privacy, isn't it? It's just like, it's just the internet. It's just what you do on the internet, isn't it? It's just not a big deal. I think that's right and wrong, and it's not the way I'd look at it. I think, you know, I'm very careful about what I put out on the internet, and very careful about when I'm careless as well. And so I always do that with intent. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because I do sort of double check things. And there are some times where you post, it's like when you do things when you're a bit drunk or something like that. You just shouldn't go on the internet when you're drunk, or certainly not on social media. Really. and you put things up that seem really, really funny. And then all of a sudden you realize you just offended someone and made yourself look quite stupid. Mm.
Well, talking about that, it does mention in here that apparently US Border Patrol or immigration have asked about having people's LinkedIn profiles and Twitter IDs and stuff. And I think it's optional at the moment, but it won't be very long before it's not. And I know of one person when that ruling, or when that started being introduced, basically deleted every tweet, I think, up until his most recent tweet.
Okay, well, that's the thing, isn't it, where you archive all your tweets and just and then pull the plug until you're just back on.
Anyway, number four, but I'm just one in millions. How can anyone see me? Yeah, as if like, oh, I'm just in a crowd. Yeah, so how am I going to get singled out? Lots of people are doing the same thing. You know, why does it matter? But actually, you know, like, it's much easier given algorithms, given search, given it's all data, much easier to find that needle in the haystack, as we've found from finding terrorists and stuff. That's the way that it works.
Yeah, I think it is. So to think that, I mean, if you think upon along the principle that even if you write a computer program to be random, it's never actually random. It's always reverse engineerable to find out how the computer has decided which numbers to pick in its randomization, because a computer did it. So it had to do it through a mathematical process. And the way that randomization is properly done is through taking some physical reading. So, for example, white noise on a screen, and snapshotting the white noise at any one point, and then mathematically randomizing the points on the white screen. But the white noise can never be actually duplicated, or replicated. So therefore, it is effectively random to all intents and purposes. But actually, computers can't be random. So therefore, if you feel like you're one of the 3 billion people using the internet regularly, that you can't be found, you're wrong.
Yeah. I'm going to actually throw a link in here, which I'd forgotten about until you mentioned that, which is Panopticlick. We have mentioned this before. This is a service of the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And what Panopticlick does is it tries to find out as much as you possibly can about you from your browser. So it'll find out what fonts you've got on your system, what particular operating system you're using, what your IP address is, all that kind of stuff. And it can find out how unique your browser is. So even though you're one of millions of people who use Chrome or Firefox and that combination of Windows and stuff, you can easily actually narrow it down pretty well.
So a similar thing, but of a different tack, is Have I Been Owned? which you can stick your email address in and see how many of your sites have been hacked. So have I been owned? Is run by Troy, someone or other. And if you put your username or your email address in there, you can see how many of the services you've used have an open database of usernames and passwords. So there's 2 billion owned accounts, and it'll tell you which ones. So I think when I put mine in, I had 5. What it didn't tell me was whether that was my Gmail address. What it didn't tell me is when that was, so that I could tell whether I'd changed my passwords to that site since I had done that.
Oh, I see.
But it did tell me that that service has had its data exposed. To be honest, I was surprised it was only 5.
Well, I mean, this is why, and we'll come on to this when we talk about security, this is why reusing a password on multiple websites, especially with your email, is such a bad idea. But we'll talk about that another time. Right, where are we on this list? We seem to be talking about for a while. Did I do the last one?
Yes, your turn. Five. I'm on the odds. So number 5 is, but I get a discount on my insurance. Yes, you may well do that. So this is aimed at health insurance, but let's talk about car insurance. So more and more, I mean, I think Norwich Union, is just a British a car insurer, underwriter or whatever, you can have an app that you put on your phone, and when you drive, you turn the app on, and if you do that all of the time, then or it matches your miles or something like that, then they will give you a discount on your insurance because you're a good driver and you've shown you've driven within the speed limit in appropriate places, etc. But you can now start to get widgets, like a little piece of kit that you put into your car, and it will communicate your driving data with your insurance company, and your insurance company will give you a discount because you've proven yourself to be a good driver who abides by the limits and doesn't go around accelerating and driving too fast and whatever. But
all these things are introduced as being optional, and like, hey, you can save money if you do this, but of course then it'll be the default, and if you don't, you'll have increased premiums. And it's the same with, I think there's some companies that allow their employees to wear, they give them free Fitbits, and the excuse is that they're raising money for charity, and if they get a certain number of steps, then they'll raise this amount of money or whatever. But it's again the insurance thing of, you know, it's supposed to be tied to wellness, but it's such a blunt instrument of, well, if you do this many steps, you get,
But, I mean, Fitbit are a pretty good company, and they don't actually look at your data; it's encrypted, and they don't read it and see it. But they do run their algorithms on it behind the scenes, but they don't actually look at the data apparently. But you need to amplify these things or manifest what it will manifest to be in the future. So if you look at the driving insurance thing, then if you imagine out of 100 people, 5 people have this thing in their car, then they're going to get a better deal because they're safe drivers and it's proven by the data. But you step that up, when it's 95 people who've got it, then you're not going to be getting those same benefits because the insurers need to make money. And so your premiums will be high again. It's just because it's early adopters, if you like, are going to reap the benefits of it, and that's going to bring more and more people on. But there's going to be a tipping point at some point. Equally, you need to have, if you're doing that to your car, you need to make sure that everybody driving your car is abiding by those limitations. Because if you break the deal with the insurance company and drive your car inappropriately, say if you're in America, a valet just going to park your car takes it for a little spin on the local racetrack or whatever. They might break that, or your children are driving your car or something like that. Then they never know that it's actually you in the car or not, and these things aren't actually personally related. So that's quite a difficult thing.
No, it is. And I just had a quick look there. Fitbit and Nike and stuff say they don't sell your data or personally identified information. But of course, even, you know, what you were talking there about, nothing's truly random. You can, even if you anonymize data, like with the NHS care data stuff, they only have to know that I live on a row of 8 houses. And if someone says, we don't know who it is, but there's a 36-year-old male who's got asthma, well, that's me, because there aren't any other 36-year-old males.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it's about that reverse engineering thing that can be done, for one. But also, I think it's worth pointing out that these products like Nike and Fitbit, they're making money out of their devices, and they provide all of this sort of data app interrogation software that you get, so you can look at, you know, your steps and whatever. And they provide all of that because they're making money out of the devices that they're selling you. So they do that as a back a sort of back channel to make it more an attractive product. But and as you'll see with things like Apple, maybe Apple still work at a premium, but now they're getting on. So they should, in theory, be able to not sell your data to anyone. You know, Apple should be able to survive if they don't sell your data, because they're getting making money out of their hardware. But their margins will be small, and they'll be looking to increase their profit margins hugely and all of the time. And it's inevitable that your data is going to be seen as a source of income at some point by these companies, possibly. But still, it's better where you pay. It's better you're going to have your data is going to be treated with more respect than if you don't.
No, definitely, yeah. Because they've got a responsibility towards paying customers. So yes. That was the insurance one, number six. But I'm getting the service for free, and very simply, they say you're not getting it for free. You're paying for it with your data.
I think it's worth saying at this point that the paying for a service with your data is probably a pretty good bargain. You know, so if you think about it, you're sort of you're paying for effectively advertising, which is where this data with this revenue is generated. You give your data to pay for advertising. You read the adverts. The adverts, in theory, are targeted towards your likes and preferences much more. So the adverts, so if you're going to get the advertising anyway, for example, then the adverts are actually better in theory.
But why should you get the advertising anyway? Why should I get advertising on the internet?
Well, there's no one saying that you should or you shouldn't, but the internet's a public space, and you get advertising in all public spaces. So, you know, you get them on the sides of buses, on bus stops, you get them in billboards, buildings, whatever, you know, it's all over the place. And where you do get things for free, like with television, they pay for it through advertising. So an advertising generated income generation model is not a new thing to us, you know.
Do you have billboard adverts in your school?
No.
Why is that?
Because we wouldn't want to. Well, for one, we don't make money out of selling advertising space within the school, basically. Right. And we would do that for, I would imagine, moral decisions. And I'm sure in some schools, I know in some schools, they have sold advertising space within the school by, you know, having Starbucks in the school, or by having, you know, sponsorship through and from technical companies for technical colleges, for example.
But people are paying for it to go into that space. So I guess the point I'm making is that I don't think it's reasonable to accept that advertising, invasive advertising, is just a fact of life, especially on the internet.
Well, I think it's true, but I think when you pursue this argument, you get to start down to the thing. People should be paying for their social media. That's just that just becomes the bottom line. And you could argue that they might do in the future, and because that you know, imagine like paying for an ad-free Twitter. Would you do that?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, so, I get annoyed by the fact that I can't. So at least, for example, with Google, I can pay for Google Apps or G Suite or whatever it's called, and I do that. So for my dynamic skill set business, although I don't choose to use Google stuff personally, it's difficult to actually separate the two, I know, but for my business, I use Google Apps. But I basically deprecated my personal Google account. But I can pay for that, and it's a different set of terms and conditions than when you do use the free version. And so I think that a really basic, easy thing, which would, I'm guessing that people like Twitter and Facebook wouldn't do this because it would actually show how expensive their services are if they weren't being subsidized by invasive advertising. I'd like to be able to turn those things off, but there's no way I can.
No, there's none. And it's stupid, isn't it? I think it's really...
I actually think that Twitter have turned off adverts on my account.
Do you?
I haven't seen an advert on there for...
Promoted tweets?
Well, in amongst my... Because every time I see one, I press the cross and I say it's inappropriate.
Oh, okay, I see. So you bother to do that. I'm not sure if I...
So I think they've given up.
Well, it could be. I can't see one. No. This is all user stuff.
Interesting.
Maybe they've changed their plan. It is all. Wow. Okay. Oh no, there was something. What was that? Missed it. Zoomed too fast. scroll too fast.
Right, just to finish this list, then the last one's yours.
Okay, it is. Number 7. I'm not from the West. This is not an issue for me. Okay.
I would say this is more of an issue for you. So, for example, in this last week, the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, where my dad did some work for a bit, they have, you know, state-owned telecoms providers, Etisalat and other ones, so they used to be able to bypass things by using VPN, but they've been banned. And there was something announced about bulk collection of data last week. I don't know exactly what, but there was a huge spike. I saw the graph. There was a huge spike in the use of Tor last week in the United Arab Emirates to get round and circumvent that from a privacy point of view. So if you live in a repressive regime, or if you live somewhere where there isn't the, well, the kind of democracy I was going to say we have in the UK and the US, although that's a debatable point at the moment. If you live in a more repressive regime, then this is an even bigger issue for you, because this is going to come and it's going to look a whole lot worse.
Yeah, I think that's it is going to become a whole lot worse. So if I was talking to a couple of gentlemen from Nigeria when I was at MozFest, and they were saying how the internet is coming, but it's but Facebook's lovely giving of the internet to them is very Facebook oriented, and you can't get out of Facebook, and the frustrations that they were finding with that sort of thing. And so people are going to have to be aware if they're from anywhere.
Well, it's pretty insidious when Facebook, you know, we talked about Facebook, what do they call it, Internet Basics or something? They were going to hoover up everyone's data. So whereas we at least get to choose, like I get to choose my internet service provider and how much I'm willing to pay extra for them not to censor and filter my stuff, there would be no choice there effectively, because, yeah, it'd all be free, but it would all be going through Facebook's servers, and they could get to choose which websites you could and couldn't visit. So there's that as well. So all of those things, all 7 of them. So just to recap, they were number 1, I've got nothing to hide. Number 2, I don't care that people know I eat cornflakes for breakfast. Number 3, it's just the internet. Number 4, but I'm just one in millions. How can anyone see me? Number 5, but I get a discount on my insurance. Number 6, but I'm getting the service for free. And number 7, I'm not from the West. This is not an issue for me. These are all not the right way of thinking about privacy online.
It looks to be a nice site with some interesting, like, control your data in 5 simple steps. I was listening to this interesting gentleman today, and he was talking about password caring services. What do you call them?
Password managers?
Managers, that's it. So a password manager, and he was saying...
I'm now going to call LastPass a password caring service.
Your passwords for the LastPass. So he was saying that, you know, it's being considered good form, and these things are like KeePass and 1Password and things. Passbolt, you use one master password that helps you log into all of your services, and that was thought to be a good thing, but that's less and less thought a good thing now, because it's not really safe to have one key that the rules them all, because it will mean that hackers just focus their attention on that one key.
So what do they suggest instead?
They suggest like the same levels of randomness and sophistication to your passwords, but that you just manage them. The security is spread. That's the only real way to do it, is to have this spread of security.
What does that mean?
It means different passwords everywhere, and not one thing that rules them all.
Well, how do you do that without a password manager?
Because by being very clever. I mean, how else? I mean, well, you know, it's just... So I'll tell you some interesting ways to do passwords. Okay, that I think is a good way. So you take different songs, and then and you would take the first letter from the words in a song that you knew. And you would just use those letters, and it would be, it can be 18, 20 characters long. Very
easy. Yeah, I know how to make pretty random passwords. But what I'm saying is, how on earth, given the number of different services I use, how am I supposed to remember all those?
That's how. So because you remember the songs and you have songs in your head committed to memory, poems might be the same, is that you can then, you can work out, you can have different songs for different things, you see what I mean?
Sorry to labour the point, but I get that, but there must be, I must have hundreds of passwords in my LastPass vault.
I think you would, and you have hundreds of songs in your mind as well, in your own vault.
Okay, right.
Maybe.
Here's what I've done. So here's what I do. I have a long master password, which I should probably change now because I've had it for a year. That all creates random passwords, which I use to sign up to websites. So I literally cannot log in without that. I use the LastPass authenticator, which generates, basically I have to have my phone with me to log into my LastPass account on a computer that I don't usually use. Now for my son, I thought about doing the same kind of thing. Now he's got a smartphone, but actually what I've decided is that I've told him to, he's got a little notebook that he got for Christmas, just one of his stocking fillers, and it's his password book. And when he's making a new password, he looks around the room and chooses three things and capitalizes each word, and they all go together as if it's one big word, then puts a number on the end. And given that he's 10 and isn't really signing up to like banking and things, that seems to suffice for the moment. But it's always going to be a trade-off, isn't it? Because if you, and this is, we're getting on security here, I guess, but if you expect people to, for example, have everything memorized and change them often for everything, people are just going to start using their fingerprints, which you can never change, which seems to get the job done. But then as soon as someone managed to clone your fingerprint, you're shafted now and forever.
Yes, it's quite interesting. So I was looking at some recommended, 15 recommended settings on Android, most of which were about Google, obviously. And one of those was about fingerprints. So it was not to have a fingerprint, so disable fingerprints, and to use a 6-digit passcode for your device. But I can't remember why they said. There was a reason why it was, and it was quite intelligent, why fingerprinting wasn't allowed. Ah, that's it. It's because you can be forced to put your fingerprint onto your device. As in, you can be asked to do it. I don't mean forced as in someone grabbing your finger. But you can't be forced to put your passcode in, apparently, somewhere in law or something.
Yeah, they can chop your finger off.
They can do that, yes.
Yeah. Anyway, that's kind of security stuff. But I think that, yeah, obviously they're two links, so it's impossible to talk about one without the other. We should talk about what people can do, because I think by now, hopefully, people are convinced that, oh, I need to do something about improving my privacy. So what can people do? Well, one of the things which is mentioned on here is something that I worked on when I was at Mozilla, is the Mozilla Learning January 2017 community newsletter, Explore Privacy Basics. So Laura Hilger, who I've already mentioned, she worked on some of this too, some of the activities. And some of it comes from the Office of the Privacy Commissioner of Canada. And I helped with the badges that Hive Toronto made in this regard. Mm-hmm. And they talk about weak versus strong passwords, like we've just said, passphrases, cookies, IP addresses, data trails, third-party tracking, and even how to become a privacy coach to peers. So there's a link to activities there as well.
Okay, it's probably useful for Saturday. I thought it was Thursday, but I've realized I am in the wrong world. Cool, they look good. I'm just going to look at the activities.
Yep. So that's them there, and it goes into more detail about, you know, some of the stuff that Mozilla is doing in terms of privacy. I think a lot of this is actually, some of it is you don't know what you don't know, and it's definitely worth knowing more about these things. But, and this might be entire supposition, I feel like some of this is stuff that people actually know, but the immediate cost of not doing it and the shininess of some of the stuff that they're using and the difficulty in extricating yourself from relationships, from building habits is just too big. I mean, in the same way that the habits that I've built up on a MacBook over 7 years I still find it slightly awkward to use a different keyboard and a different way of doing stuff. It's a similar kind of thing when it comes to privacy habits and that kind of thing. And for example, getting off Facebook for some people is all but impossible.
I think so, and people don't want to get off it, and I don't think they have to really if they want to. This, so I think the big thing, and that this is the thing about Data Privacy Day as well, is awareness. So it's about awareness that your data's out there, it's being used by companies, and how your data is doing that. So, for example, so I did this for an Android phone. Again, I'm teaching this sort of thing this week, so we're looking at the different, you know, the way data tracks you. And if you've never looked at your data, like your location data, either on iOS, it's under your settings in general, I think. There's location settings, and it's frequently visited places or something like that. That's what you need to go and check out under there, just going through the hierarchy in your settings. But on Android, the recommendations are, if you want to like secure your phone and just tighten up your data footprint, or how much data is getting leaked out there. So you mentioned pass lock, not fingerprint. Disable your cloud backup. Even this is inconvenient. You can plug your device into your computer and back up like that. Disable, what is it? Smart lock for passwords, so your passwords are not remembered by your device. Disable ads. So you have your advertising thing going into Google. In your Google settings, you can go and turn ads off, or targeted ads off, sorry. So they're not picking up your data.
Only turn on your location when you need it.
Absolutely. You limit, and then limiting Google Now is a big thing as well. So you finally chain location access. That's the thing that you've been just mentioned. Decrease your sleep timeout so that your phone switches off. Just, this is a physical thing for people next to you, can't see what's on your phone. Auto lock immediately on the power button so that your phone is locked and requires a passcode again to get back into it. Enable your device erase function, which is on by default anyway, but so you can remote wipe your device should you lose it. Hide sensitive notification content so that people can't see your messages, that you can just see that you've got messages but not what is in them. Disable unknown source, or this is downloading apps and things from unknown sources only relevant to
apps. Where are you getting this from, Doe?
I can't remember, somewhere. And check.
Oh, is this your list of things?
Well, that's just a list of a website. It's not mine. Oh. I just used it in my lessons.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But it was off one website, so it's just an interesting sort of list of things to go through. Just Google for it and how to secure your Android, and it will give you a list of things. It wasn't a deep dive, you know. And so I think that's important. And is that awareness? Tell me what do you think, Doug, about the idea of A, running an offline computer that is only ever offline. B, running multiple identities, so multiple email addresses that you use for specific activities only. Do you think that has any efficacy?
Well, it depends. So all of this depends what your threat model is. So I mentioned this earlier, and so what this is in the kind of security community, you have to kind of decide who your adversary is likely to be. So if it's like the government and the NSA with an unlimited budget and the smartest people in the world working for them, then you have to do crazy amounts of stuff. So what you mentioned there about having an offline computer, that's often known as an air-gapped one, as in there's a physical gap of air between it and a network and all that kind of stuff. So you'd have to like build it from scratch yourself with parts that you got other people to buy for you, etc., and it would never go on the internet, that kind of thing, which is unreasonable. And even then, there's been cases of things getting through Bluetooth, through all kinds of stuff. So, you know, the story of the Stuxnet worm that got into that Iranian nuclear reactor, I think some of that got through air-gapped computers, which is crazy. Mm-hmm. In terms of, what was the other thing you mentioned? Having different identities.
Yeah, different emails.
So the problem there, if you read any guide about activists, and, you know, there were people within the network at Mozilla who were activists and working as far as possible under the radar in quite repressive regimes, is that even one mistake where you go on a machine and you happen to be logged into the two different accounts at the same time is enough to compromise them for all time. And sometimes you don't even realize you've done it. So if your adversary is like a government actor, you need like proper hardcore training on how to do that. I don't think I'd be able to do it at the moment. But if your adversary is hackers who are trying to get into anyone's account, really, doesn't really matter whose it is, to get money out of it, you just need to be, it's a bit like running away from a bear. You just need to be faster than someone else in your group so that you don't get eaten.
Yeah.
So your privacy hygiene, as it's sometimes called, just needs to be better than other people so that they give up. It's a bit like somebody cruising the streets looking for doors or cars or something that are unlocked. As long as you've done a reasonable amount of stuff, they're probably going to break into someone else's car or house.
Oh, okay. So that's that. Let's go for a different direction then. So what would you say if I were to irritate you by saying that it's important? So at the moment, personal data is out there and it's up for grabs and it's being used as a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
However, if we know nothing about the world other than the fact that it keeps changing, or society keeps changing in the way that we do these things, then surely this personal data thing is going to actually work its way out through democratic elections and global corporations looking to make a profit as people start caring about it. And we don't need to be too bothered about our data right now, really, because it's a period of transition.
So, interesting. I think that if you have fair exchange, then it's up to you what you do. If you know the value of the thing that you've got in this bag, metaphorical bag, and you are exchanging that for the thing in someone else's metaphorical bag, and you're exchanging those bags, and then that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an unequal relationship, and you're giving them extremely valuable stuff, which increases in value over time as they have more data points. And in return, you're getting something which is fun and connects you with people, or whatever it is, but it's difficult to put a value on it, if you see what I mean. So it's not a informed exchange. So in the same way that you'd think there was something wrong if, to use a stereotypical example, someone managed to extort lots of money out of an old person and did give them some kind of service, but something which was worth, you know, 50 quid went, and they were charging them 10 grand for it, you'd think there was something wrong with that. Mm-hmm. In the same way, I think there's an asymmetrical relationship between what we're getting out of so-called free services and what they're getting in return. You've got to remember, these companies are worth billions, some of them, and that's not because they're doing anything other than like selling your data.
Okay, one more step. one more step is the fact that these companies can have our data, do have our data, and are selling it and making money out of that is equally the reason why technology is advancing in the way that it is. So these same big corporations that are making money out of us while we use their services for free, which I agree might be an asymmetric exchange, it's not balanced. But still, they are the companies that are employing the best new methods from the best developers in the world to take technology forward, and the sort of byproducts of that technology moving forward is actually helping people in ways that they couldn't be helped before. So an example of that would be looking at, say, robotics and exoskeletons to help people who can't walk.
So two counterexamples to that. The first one, did you read Craig Mod's widely read and widely shared post, How I Got My Attention Back?
Oh, I did.
So the second example I want to give is Uber. So if I forget, just tell me Uber. So the first one of this, and I read this to my son, who's recently installed the game that Craig Mod talks about, Clash of Clans, on his phone. I've only just let him start playing it. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but the gist of this is that this guy, Craig Mod, well known on the internet, he was in Myanmar, formerly Burma, on a research job, and realized that all the farmers were sitting on top of their buffalo in the fields where the 3G was strongest, and they were spending ages on this game, Clash of Clans. So he started playing it, even though he's not that much of a gamer, to try and figure out like what was going on, because he was doing this research project. And he basically got sucked in by the algorithm. He only spent $40 over the 5 months, but the last day he played it for 10 hours straight. And this is a guy who knows how these things work. And he talks about how he thought he was just a bad player, because it wasn't letting him win. But he realized that actually what it was, like you say, very smart people motivated by money who are using all of the psychological tricks, everything, every trick in the book to part him with his money, attention, and time. So there's that. The second thing is...
So can I just say, I can't remember where I saw this, but a really interesting thing, a really interesting concept of that games are actually designed never to let you win.
Yeah.
And they're pushing and pushing and pushing. So you can. So it's quite interesting that you play a game with this idea of getting to the light at the end of the tunnel. I might argue that that's never actually what you want to do, but there's a sense that that's what you're driving for. But the game is designed to always stop you from doing that.
That's right. So I'm in a really tricky parenting situation, actually, here, in that I never want to... There's some things I will absolutely ban him from doing, because it's an obvious thing. But here, he was given some, you know, he was given 20 quid in Google Play vouchers by my parents on my recommendation. And he's obviously got the choice of whether to buy a game outright or to get a free game and upgrade it. So he's been buying gems in Clash Royale and, you know, that kind of thing. And I want him to come to the realization himself that he's wasted his money. So in the same way that sometimes he goes and buys, you know, those trading cards and stuff, I want him to realize himself that he wastes his money. There's no point in me lecturing him. And Craig Mod, in this article, How I Got My Attention Back, talks about the stark difference between Clash of Clans and the new game Mario Run, which is out on iOS and it's coming out on Android soon. He says, these are the only two mobile titles I've picked up in earnest in the last, say, 20 years, but the difference between Clash of Clans and Mario couldn't be starker. Mario is finite, bounded. The edges are clear. You pay once and there's no other way for Nintendo to extract money from you. No single player is a mark. There are no whales. In Mario, you can not only see the end, but get there. Your points max out at 9,999. Mario Run is human scale. Clash of Clans is machine scale, network scale. Which I find really interesting. And all these things, this model, I think it started with Zynga and Farmville and things. It's a very different type of game, a very different type of attention-grabbing, money-generating, time-sapping kind of thing than we've been used to. And so I don't think we can legitimately say these things will just come out in the wash, because they are, like I said before, insidious. They're purposely targeting our human vulnerabilities, which is what concerns me as a parent, to make us respond in very particular ways. So that's that.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Although no one ever got told off for playing too much chess, but hey.
Mm.
My difficult questions, I think.
Sorry?
I finished with my difficult questions.
Well, I was just going to say about Uber. So
Uber, you were, yes.
Uber, as a business, should have already failed, because it's done nothing but lose money since it was invented, yeah?
Uh-huh.
And it's been going how long? 5 years or whatever? But
right.
People and venture capitalists keep pouring money into it because they see it as, you know, what's going to happen when we go beyond, you know, when we have self-driving cars and, you know, Uber as, when people talk about Uber for this or Uber for that, it's not just a, like a ride-sharing thing or a taxi app. It's a way in which people think the future is going to play out. So they're willing to invest their time, their attention, all this kind of stuff in it, because they want that particular version of the future to play out. But
that's,
if it wasn't for the literally billions that have been poured into it, it would be a failed experiment. It would be a failed business.
A headline note here from Bloomberg, August 2016. Uber loses at least $1.2 billion in first half of 2016.
Yep.
That's huge. Really, really interesting. And I didn't know that. I didn't know it wasn't making money in that way, because it's making people money. It's making its drivers money. But obviously Uber as a company is not making it. And the question that I'd really like answered by anybody listening, should you have got this far, is what's happened to, so there are, I've just been checking my Twitter a little bit as we've been talking, and there are no promoted tweets on it. What's happened to that? How have Twitter got clever? There's no, I can't find any traces on the web of Twitter promoted tweets going. So
I did read that they'd decided to turn them off for some users, but they didn't release any details as to how they were deciding to do that. Now, with me literally pressing on every advert, this is inappropriate, this is inappropriate, this is inappropriate. Like, it seems I would be a pretty good candidate for turning off adverts if they were trying to do that.
Yeah, I have done a few of those as well. I mean, on Instagram at the moment, they're just heinous. It's like every fifth bloody post or something is an advert.
But again, you know, if somebody's recently joined Twitter and, oh, you know, Twitter has adverts like Facebook, oh, right, okay, fine. As opposed to us who have only really got used to adverts or not even got used to adverts in the last, you know, couple of years or whatever. Uh-huh. So there's that. So, you know, people, talking about that Robert McFarlane book, he talks about that syndrome or that psychological reality that people think that the state of nature is whatever the world was like when they were born or when they were very young. And they kind of want to go back to that, but they don't realize that actually even that was very impoverished compared to what went before. I don't think it was the book that I've just been reading, but he talks about, you know, when the first white people went over to America, the streams were literally full of fish. Like, you could put your hand in the stream and pull them out. Passenger pigeons went, and there's not even any passenger pigeons left as far as I can gather, blacked out the sky. You had to wait 6 hours for buffalo to go past. Whereas now we just think that natural things are the stuff that were around us when we were young. And it's a similar kind of thing with the web and our information environment. We see advertising on the web, to go back to the earlier point, as being an entirely normal thing. This is how the web works. Yeah. But I can remember the web before it got like that. And I'm hoping that there's going to be a web after this. There's a huge problem. The kind of concept and the discussion around the digital divide seems to have gone away quite a lot since we've got lots of free services and, you know, the price of smartphones and laptops and different Chromebooks and all that kind of stuff has come down. But there still is a digital divide, but it's a digital literacy divide. And what we have is people who can afford to buy fancy stuff like Apple things have potentially more privacy built in by default because they don't have to monetize anything other than the hardware at the moment. And then you've got people like me and people who know more than me deciding to take control of our privacy and security by using things like Linux and configuring our things and going to insane lengths and time to do that kind of thing. But for people who are new to these things, who haven't got the skills and haven't got the money, it's a very problematic situation, which is hidden because we don't have the financial digital divide. If that makes sense.
Yes, it does. It's interesting, isn't it? It's interesting the sort of things we're hitting on. Uber's being hoited around as the non-asset business model, and yet it's not making any money. That's really quite a scary thing because people are talking about it as the way to make things happen.
Mm. If you think about when people use different Silicon Valley companies as metaphors, people say Uber for this or Amazon for that. But Amazon, there's been huge exposés. I feel slightly guilty for using them so much. The excuse I give is that I live in semi-rural Northumberland and therefore to get to half the stuff that I would like, I'd have to drive miles and da da da. But you know, Amazon's warehouses, business models, etc., the way that they've completely destroyed some industries, Uber's, like I've just talked about, entirely propped up by venture capitalist money, other things as well, these massive unicorns, as they're called, Twitter, like these aren't good businesses really in terms of the finance behind them, the privacy, which is why I'm so interested in cooperative business models. So yeah, I think we can do better.
I think it's interesting, and it sort of harks back to the point I was trying to make earlier, really, in one of my awkward questions, which is that we are in transition. There's no way that Uber is going to sustain beyond a certain point. It is going to die at some point. People are going to stop pouring money into it, and the same for all of these companies that are having trouble making money. Is that at some point that bubble is going to burst?
Yeah, I mean, we're always in transition. The interesting thing is that at what point do we realize that a particular, like, we can draw a circle around a particular period of time and say, oh, that, you know, like recently researchers have named the time that we live in now the Anthropocene, I think, you know, in terms of the impact that man has had on the environment. there's looking back, and I think people like Clay Shirky are pretty good at doing this, describing a state of affairs which started at a particular time, and you can kind of mark out a time when it started, and you can mark out time when it finished. And people who can do that, who can see the way those patterns work, are extremely valuable to all of us, I think. But it's difficult for us who live in that stream to notice. It's almost like boiling the frog, isn't it? Like you can't feel how it's changing as it's happening. You need those people who've got that deep insight.
I think that's absolutely true. And there's lots of frogs being boiled very soon at the moment, aren't there? Really, that is how the world feels at the moment, I think, is exactly that. Okay.
Right, what should we do now? I mean, there's an interesting post by Kin Lane, who is Audrey Waters' partner, and the API guy. They are they do a wonderful podcast called The Tech Gypsies. If you listen to this and you don't also listen to The Tech Gypsies, then you're missing out. They actually had some really good stuff, which I want to talk about perhaps next time on the second part of this particular theme, that when they were talking about the way that we teach information literacy having to change given that the Trump administration controls the .gov domains. Anyway, that's that. But Kin Lane, in this particular post, it's entitled "When the Companies Who Have All Your Digital Bits Promise Not to Recreate You." It's fascinating. Do you get a chance to read this?
I've not read this. No, tell me about it.
So what it is, tragically, Carrie Fisher died recently, and she was halfway through filming one of the Star Wars films. So the assumption in lots of circles was that she would then be digitally recreated to finish off that performance. And this isn't new technology. Gladiator, the film that came out in the year 2000, I forgot the name of the guy, but he died drinking in Valletta in Malta, and they finished off by digitally superimposing his head onto someone else's body. You know, it's obviously more advanced now, 17 years later, but in the same way that Tupac and Michael Jackson became holograms, they can recreate Carrie Fisher. But Lucasfilm have promised not to do that. And so what Kin talks about in this particular one is, and he talks about pretty prosaic stuff like Evernote, is to what extent can and should and will companies who have access to all of your data eventually recreate you? In the same way that Facebook by default can use your digital identity to sell their services to other people, like, oh, Di Barnes thinks this is awesome, so should you, etc. To what extent will they be able to analyze your tweets and basically create, you know, the bot version of Di Barnes, which you might want to actually create for after, if and when you die, but they're using it obviously to make money. So it's just really interesting, and he's coming at from it from a owning your own API and owning your own stuff point of view. But just the way that he frames this, I think, is fascinating.
It's an interesting idea, isn't it? I've never thought about that before, but I've never personally suffered a shock bereavement, but you can imagine somebody who's grieving quite seriously about it because they have had a shock bereavement, that they might want to recreate the person who has passed in some way, not necessarily hologram degrees, but I'm just thinking, you know, as voice operated computers are becoming more of a thing, and the amount of data or that somebody has shared, their tweets, their updates, their whatever, their podcasts, I don't know, there are lots of things out there on the internet that represent a person potentially, that you could recreate that person in different ways. If you've got enough money to make someone go through all that data and work it out and the computers to do that, that's possibly a thing that might happen, isn't it, in the future, you know?
Yeah.
Somebody's around, or maybe that's just a new version of looking back at the old videos of family videos, you know, I don't know.
Well, I mean, he doesn't explicitly talk about China in this post, but it's the equivalent of someone puts up a Kickstarter for something which finishes a month later, and by the time the Kickstarter's finished, because the plans are on the Kickstarter thing, it's already been made and it's on sale in China. Like, it's that, but your digital identity in the human equivalent.
Yes, absolutely. Imagine bumping into yourself. I mean, I watched some funny snippets of whatever over the holiday, and I remember there was apparently I used to watch EastEnders back in the day, and I haven't watched it for years. And Peggy died of cancer, sadly. Who's a big character in EastEnders, and they brought back another character in ghost format to have the last conversation with her, you know, like her big sort of padre kind of thing.
Really?
Padre's the wrong word, her big, you know, best friend from days gone by, already left the show. They brought her back in a kind of ghost format just to do a last couple of sentences of back in the old days. And yeah, I don't know.
Wow.
That sort of, yeah, I'm just trying to say you get that quite a lot. You think about Star Wars, for example, and you think about Star Trek as well, actually. They're always doing this thing where they recreate somebody in a different time period, or the Jedi Knights are standing there in ghost formats in the swamps of wherever land. And you know, that's a thing that is imagination projection, I guess, isn't it? I don't know. Maybe that will become more of a reality in time.
Yeah, there's a difference between... Yeah, I don't want to go into that actually, but there's a difference between sentimental and the human element of that versus doing things pretty cynically for...
Completely. Yeah. Completely. Absolutely. I agree.
Right, there's a couple more links to put in here, but I don't think we'll bother doing that. One was about Proton Mail, which I considered as being my new personal email platform. It's a Swiss-run thing which encrypts your vault and does it can do easily one-click encrypted email. They now allow you to do that over Tor, like that I mentioned before. And for those who don't know, Tor is a way that it bounces your data around the web, so that by the time it gets to the end of it, it's pretty difficult to know where it's come from. Another one, I don't particularly want to go into this now, was it was reported by the MIT magazine, one startup's vision to reinvent the web for better privacy. And anytime I see the word startup and reinvent in the title, I tend to switch off, I have to say.
So did you, you said you considered it, but you didn't do it? Proton Mail.
No, I decided to go with, so having not mentioned this, I used to use Fastmail, which is great and recommended, and they're hosted in Germany and Australia, and it works well. Yeah. But I realized I never used the calendaring function. Actually, I just use my, because everything I calendar is either created on our family calendar and therefore it's on my wife's Gmail account, or it's my business one. So I just use Google Calendar. So really I was only looking for email, and I thought, well, why don't I just go for one that's free and open source and one that aligns with my values? And the one that does is one called Colab, K-O-L-A-B. It's been around for 20 years or something, and it's entirely reasonable, and it does everything I need it to do, and it's hosted in Switzerland as well, I believe. So because Swiss have good privacy laws, so I'm happy with that, and really can't tell much difference between that and Fastmail, but there we go.
Okay, fair enough. Cool. Okay, are we done?
Yeah, well, I think almost. I think if we scroll past, let's talk about the Safer Internet Day links next time.
I think we should. I think it'd be interesting today in digital education that we actually did a show dedicated to Safer Internet Day.
I'll just stick some links, and let's see how many of these we want to cover today and how many, because we'll have some more by next week or the week after whenever we do the next one. I'll just stick these other links that are in here into the miscellaneous section. There's one hilarious one that I definitely do want to cover now, and it's the top one. It's a report in the Daily Telegraph, which obviously they're always on the side of the establishment. So the title that they've chosen to give this one is Headmistress Scuppered by Red Tape as She Tried to Use Mobile Phone Jamming Technology to Stop Children Using Internet in Class. Did you see this?
Yeah, I had a meeting with six different husbands who are housemasters and housemistresses the other week for a couple of hours one evening. And we talked about banning mobile phones in year 9, which is our first full boarding year, that sort of thing. And we actually ended up, a little bit of a hat tip to you possibly, we actually ended up with having a digital a detox for 1 week in the year for every pupil and every teacher, which means that we'll only use internal services of email, our VLE and our video streaming service, which are all held on site. So, but the internet will actually be blocked for the week, and that will.
I was citing you actually. I was down in Jersey again last week at Victoria College, and they've now appointed a head of digital strategy or whatever it is to come for Easter. So you know, I'll be being phased out there, which is good because they've got someone to come in permanently. Okay. So at the moment, obviously, they haven't got a. I don't think they'd be bothered about me talking about this, but they haven't got a completely joined up policy. And like in lots of schools, you get people who jump from, especially when they're not so sure about technology, jump from zero to banning in one step rather than several. So lots of great stuff happening in technology in that school. In this particular case, it was a kid who couldn't use Google Apps for their homework because they'd been banned on using the computers by another teacher. And it just shows, like in every education institution up and down the country, there's joined up thinking to be done. Yeah. So certainly not something which that particular school is, you know, unusual for. It's just an example of having joined up thinking. So I was talking about the way that I think you've described this on a previous podcast, how you had been monitoring the load, not only for staff, but for students in terms of the number of emails, notifications and stuff they received. So I think there's something like a detox where there's an expectation that people will be using digital stuff less is a great signal to put out, and to do that like for different groups at a time is a wonderful idea.
Yeah, I'm thinking, yeah. So when I look at doing something like that, I also want to do the opposite as well. So I'm thinking, say for Internet Day, I'm going to try and get teachers to use a website in class and to analyze its sort of validity, reliability, bias stuff. Mm. So that they get a bit of an education about these things, and they're also, children will get that will hit them in their lessons.
Back to this story, it says, Julia Polly, head at Wensleydale School and Sixth Form College in Leyburn, North Yorkshire, was so frustrated at students' fixation with their smartphones that she told parents she'd be blocking 4G internet at the school. So basically, she bought a jammer, something which would stop the signal. And she was then told, I think by the police, actually, that that would be illegal because it would stop the emergency services broadcasts, etc. So I thought that was hilarious. It's a criminal offence under the Wireless Telegraphy Act to use any apparatus for the purposes of deliberately interfering with radio communications in the UK.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So it blocks the emergency services as well, and their separate communications network that they have for times of crisis. But this was mentioned at the husband's meeting, actually, which brought it up in the first place. Couldn't we do this? So it's just rubbish. Obviously, you can't do it.
So you've mentioned before how you haven't got a great 4G signal where you are. So, you know, over and above what the school provides, there isn't like huge capacity.
Correct.
But,
I think it's quite interesting as well. So there's a school not that far away from here, within 50 miles or so, boarding school, the same. And they have just removed all of their filters from the internet. Because they decide, I'm getting this confirmed and haven't had it confirmed yet, but I haven't cited the school. But I still don't know if it's true. But the principle for that is that wherever they look, it keeps coming back down to the matter of education.
Yeah,
so let's make education the complete focus rather than trying to do locking and do that as well. So I thought that was a really interesting take on it.
It's difficult, isn't it? Yeah, you want them to make informed choices rather than just banning them from doing it. What else should we choose? We've talked about how I got my attention back, that article. So I'll just make sure that link is further up there. Anything else jump out at you before we finish?
Moderate screen use boosts team well-being.
Mm-hmm. Did you see that?
I did have a quick scan of this, yeah. A BBC article, isn't it? And it's just that... oddly, doing this in moderation is pretty cool.
Yep.
And that's the thing. Take screens away from me, Doug. I'd be an unhappy punter, I tell you.
Well, this is going to sound... I haven't told anyone else this, and now I'm telling everybody, but this sounds absolutely pathetic. But, you know, I noticed a massive difference. When I took my daughter swimming, I take her swimming at 10:30 on a Saturday morning, and it's a half an hour session. I'm up in the gallery, and I can see her all the time, and she very rarely looks up at me. But, you know, I love watching her swim and getting better. Now, when I was on my detox in December, I actually found it very easy just to concentrate on her all the time. Since I've come back, Di, I've almost got a twitch. Like, I can't get off my phone. And I was actually quite proud of myself that I didn't touch my phone for the entire half an hour where my beautiful six-year-old daughter was swimming. And I just thought how pathetic that was.
But you see, I like that, right? So twitch management, okay, is the big thing for me. So whenever I feel the twitch, right, the automatic pull for phone, do you know what I mean? Hand going to where phone is located or whatever. That's like an alarm. It's just a little alert. It's a little prod that says, what are you doing? I like that feeling of twitch because it reminds me that that habits are being formed without me intending to form them.
Yeah.
So, but well done for not touching, keeping off. Good.
Okay, well, on that, let's leave that there for this time. So let's call this part one. Let's call this A Safer, More Private Internet Part 1. And we'll do part two, which will be, although we've touched on security stuff, will be much more about safety, security, that kind of thing. It'll be closer to Safer Internet Day itself, which is on the 7th of February. For those who have been listening and this has been recorded on Tuesday, this will probably go out Wednesday or Thursday. It's Saturday, which is Data Privacy Day. Think about doing something next week if you're in a way of being able to do that. If you're not, think about how you could do that 8-day detox yourself. Think about how you could kind of make your digital life a bit more private. So finally, Di, what are you doing this week just to sign off?
Okay, bet on Thursday. Hoping to catch up with a few people. And see some nice shiny kit. I've got a sort of a kit focus this year for so at my school we invest in technology for classrooms, not for teachers. So I'm looking to sort of make that transition happen. Mm. So it's about getting the right tech in the hands of teachers for the one-to-one pilot that I've discussed before. So we're doing that. It's going to take, I think Surfaces are pretty much winning at the moment and they're possibly going to be the thing we go with. But I'm going to look at alternatives that I discussed earlier at BET. And other than that, I'm just doing my job teaching.
Mm. Cool. It's our co-op day for We Are Open Co-op on Thursday. So spending all day working on stuff, planning, that kind of thing. Always enjoy that. So with Laura, who we've already mentioned, and Brian Mathers and John Bevan, that'll be BET on Friday afternoon and Saturday. And then I guess I'll be taking most of Monday off because I'll be working at the weekend, working on the Badge News newsletter, and then I'm off to Victoria College in Jersey again. So, yeah, interesting times.
Busy times.
Yeah. Good. All right, then.
I hope you enjoy BET and have a good time.
Yes, I assume I'm not going to see you there, but these things haven't I enjoyed meeting up last time.
But there we go, that's the way. And we'll talk about that, I guess, when we speak next as well.
Yeah. Okay, cheers, everyone.
Good time. Bye-bye.
Watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a darker bay, wasting time.